possible until hitting international airspace. Russian technology remained encapsulated in the late 1980s, which gave them a slim chance. Never tell me the odds. The weather was turning for the worse. If Thorne and Jonathan had delayed extract, it was likely they were all trapped on the island, with no means of escape. Reese rounded a bend and turned the wheel right, leaving what passed for a road and going directly for the Bering Sea. A horseshoe-shaped cove visible through the windshield. It looked protected enough from the weather. It would be possible to get a plane in and out. The only thing missing was the plane. Reese slammed on the brakes as a lone figure stepped into their path 50 yards ahead, a Belgian-made FAL rifle pointed directly at them. Reese managed to find the door handle and pushed it open, showing his empty hands to the old gunfighter before exposing his head and identifying himself to Rafe's father. The old man lowered his rifle and charged toward the vehicle.
"What the bloody hell? Where's Rafe?"
Reese paused and closed his eyes.
"Rafe's in the back, sir. He's pretty banged up. I think a broken arm and a bad leg break. Probably a concussion. If we don't get him medical attention, he's not going to make it."
The old man's eyes bore straight through the younger commando in front of him, the same green eyes as his son, asking the question without saying the words, "What happened to my daughter?"
"Eli told me, Reese. He told me. Hina is dead."
Reese's eyes filled with emotion.
I'm sorry, sir. We were too late."
Jonathan was a man accustomed to the loss that comes from a lifetime of war in the African bush, but now the old man felt a new and awful emptiness move into his soul. He'd left the death, the executions, the genocide, and the torture behind on the dark continent, and even so, the darkness had found him. Now his youngest was gone. Her wild spirit was free. "Jonathan," Reese said in a measured tone, "we have to get out of here. How long ago did the plane leave?" The usually stoic old warrior swallowed hard. He'd aged a decade since Montana. "Jonathan?"
"They left an hour ago. Thorne, Farkas, Devon, Eli, and Chavez, along with the prisoners. Farkas wasn't doing well. Those crazy bastards all wanted to stay, but I wouldn't hear of it. They'd done enough. If my son and daughter weren't leaving this island, then I wasn't either. I couldn't go home without my children. They could go home to theirs."
"Attu Island is our only way out. It's directly east. Load up."
"What are you going to do, lad? Drive there?"
"There has got to be a way to communicate in that lodge. These Russians had working night vision, which means they had a secure area where whatever they hit us with to take out our electronics wouldn't penetrate. We need to find it and reach the naval base on Attu."
"No one is going to send the Coast Guard to invade Russia and rescue us with a band of mercenaries. Thorne and the team are probably getting locked up as we speak. I saw it in Africa, Reese. No one is coming but Russians. I plan on taking as many as I can with me before I go."
Reese nodded in understanding. He had wanted to die when his wife and daughter were taken from him, and he'd wanted to kill as many of those responsible before he went down. He opened his mouth to argue, but another voice broke through the sub-Siberian air, an American voice with no hint of a Russian accent.
"Drop your weapons or die."
Chapter 85. Reese and Jonathan instinctively went to a knee as three dark, dry suit clad commandos holding M4 carbines converged on their position.
"Names,"
the unknown voice commanded.
"Fuck you,"
Jonathan hissed. Reese pushed his FAL toward the ground.
"It's okay," Reese said before directing his attention to the new threat. "I'm James Reese. I'm here with Rafe and Jonathan Hastings."
"I'd ask you the word of the day, but I'm sure you don't know it,"
the man who was obviously in charge said as he moved in closer, lowering his rifle.
"I'm Lieutenant Kevin O'Malley, SDV Team 1.
You guys must be pretty important to divert us from a redacted. Paragraph redacted. We've got a man down in the back of the truck, Rhys said, moving to his feet. He can't walk and needs a medic. Multiple EKIA are down. I don't think there are any others, but Russian military is probably inbound.
Oh, they're inbound, all right, the SEAL leader confirmed.
Charlie 01 to Nautilus, I pass touchdown. I say again, touchdown, the platoon commander said into his OSK headset. Then, hitting a push-to-talk attached to what Rhys recognized as an L3 Harris ANPRC-163 handheld radio, he said, Charlie 1-1, call in the Z-Birds and send Spanky up. We've got a non-ambulatory friendly here. O'Malley put out his hand. Nice to meet you, sir. I've heard a lot about you. Not sure what you're doing in Russia, but whatever it is, we are here to get you out.
The team's medic emerged out of the morning light and climbed into the odd-looking 6x6 to assess his patient.
What happened?
He asked as his hands checked for a pulse and worked his way down Rafe's body.
He took a tumble off a cliff and nearly drowned, Rhys replied. That was after he was shot with a crossbow. Is he going to make it?
He's hypothermic. He's breathing and has strong distal pulses, but these displaced compound fractures have me worried. Starting IV. Need to get him to the IDC. We need to extract now, the medic directed at his platoon commander.
O'Malley turned back to Rhys.
Sir, we have got to get you off this beach. We have a JMAU SRT standing by. He'll be in good hands. The extract platforms are on their way. They might be a little different than the ones you used. Sub is waiting for us 4 nautical miles out.
What? How did you know where we were?
Above my pay grade, O'Malley said, clearly not sure what he was allowed to divulge. All I know is that this is an agency-directed op. We have a maritime branch liaison on the sub with us who helped coordinate.
A change in the tone of the surf caused Rhys to pick his head up.
That's our ride, O'Malley said in response to Rhys's questioning look.
The two Zodiacs, or combat rubber raiding craft, that emerged out of the fog looked more akin to stealth fighters than the Z-Birds Rhys had used in the teams.
Times change, O'Malley said before keying his mic. Chief, we need a couple guys to help carry. Time to load up.
Two SEALs wearing dark green dry suits materialized from the perimeter, and two more maneuvered up the beach from the Black Zodiacs. One carried a Skedco tactical sked that he transformed into a stretcher in the center of the perimeter. They all assisted the medic in moving Rafe's broken and unconscious body from the vehicle and strapped him into the green flexible plastic stretcher, IV bag on his chest. Rhys grabbed a handle and heard O'Malley say, "Moving," into his radio. They patrolled toward the ocean, toward freedom, the naval commandos bracketing the stretcher in a tight diamond formation with weapons up looking for threats. As they reached the surf zone, Rhys could see that their extraction platforms were very similar to the Zodiacs he'd used in the teams, but had what looked to be a radar-deflecting or absorbing shell over the top to eliminate or reduce radar signature. The engines were muffled or possibly even electric to reduce sound. The naval commandos turned the boats so the bows were pointed back out to sea in a well-practiced maneuver. They loaded from the front as the helmsman timed the waves, waiting for everyone to climb aboard, judging his opportunity to race through the breakers. As they loaded Rafe into their extract platform, Rhys turned to Jonathan, and over the sound of the cascading surf pulled him close.
"I'm not coming with you."
"What the bloody hell?"
"My mission's not over. You go. Get home to Caroline. Mourn your daughter. Take care of Rafe. Also, I need you to talk with Thorne and have him get in touch with Vic Rodriguez at the CIA. It is imperative that he lets the agency think I made it back with you through official channels. The Russians can't think I'm still here."
"Get in the boat, you bloody idiot,"
Jonathan shot back.
"The man who killed my father is here. Not on Medni, but he's close, and I know where." Overhearing the conversation, Lieutenant O'Malley turned, the angry sea surging around his waist, the other operators looking impatiently at their senior officer.
"Sir, my orders are to bring you back. We can't have an American captured dead or alive on Russian soil."
"Don't worry, Lieutenant, I have a history of doing things like this."
"You'll never leave here alive, son,"
Jonathan's demeanor changed as he unslung his FAL and handed it to the former frogman. If that's true, I want you to tell Katie something for me.
What's that?
Semper. With that, Reese turned and sprinted back up the beach. Chapter 86. Siberia, Russian Far East. Winter. As winter settled upon the harsh land, a rumor began to swirl among the villages of the Krasnoyarsk Krai. A ghost was moving across the tundra, sometimes taking the shape of the animals that inhabited the wilderness. Some of the stories described him as half-man and half-beast. Still others were sure one of the brown bears that inhabited the interior had killed a nomadic hunter, merging their souls. The stories were passed along in the way they had since the first peoples had moved into this land, following the herds that gave them sustenance. The ghost would occasionally steal food and supplies from villages along his path, always a gift left in exchange. No one knew his destination, but it was rumored he was heading west, toward what or whom was unknown. Mothers maintained an attentive eye on their children, keeping them closer than usual. Fathers and hunters took an extra minute to pause and study the landscape before closing their doors at night. Once, a village heard a gunshot in the distance. Even specters had to eat. A native kayak had been found by children playing on the peninsula. It had been dragged into the tree line. Its owner was nowhere to be found. A motorcycle had disappeared in Elita, and the phantom had stolen a snowmobile in Tanzi Bay. When the men of the settlement caught up with it, it was abandoned and empty of gas. An offering of fresh meat was on the seat as payment, tracks of native snowshoes leading off into the snow. The men knew better than to track an apparition, wearing snowshoes or not. That would not end well. It was best not to meddle in the ways of the spirit world. The wise old men of the villages believed the hunter was caught between this world and the next. He was on a journey and wouldn't rest until it was done. Village to village, the rumor spread, some leaving offerings to the spirit as he drifted across the land, flour, smoked fish, sugar. On he went, passing villages and settlements, in his natural element moving toward his target. He had never felt so free. There was only the hunt. Chapter 87. Krasnoyarsk Krai, Russia, 6 months later. Reese had spent days watching from his hide site in the hillside. The animal skins kept him warm, and the marmot jerky he'd most recently dried nourished his body. He knew he'd lost weight and muscle mass moving over 2,000 kilometers across Siberia, hunting for the man who had killed his father. Hate kept him warm. Thoughts of Katie, his homeland, his future, were buried. He had built fires when he was able, slept in snow caves or debris shelters, and kept moving. One step at a time, always forward. He used the FAL sparingly. The bow became his primary weapon for the procurement of food. He preferred it that way. He traveled as the ancient hunter-gatherers had moved, nomads following the migrating herds, foraging as they went, in a constant struggle to survive. Reese had a different purpose that pushed him forward. A violent nomad, he had a mission. Death. He knew they'd come. The MI-8 circled and landed on the gravel HLZ just outside the main house. An older man emerged from the helicopter first, the lead from the advance detail running to the chopper door to escort him and his guest to the relative warmth of the dacha. Then came the little man. At this distance, a positive identification was not possible, but Reese was not working within the confines of the law. Reese knew. The small man bundled up against the cold was his prey. The traitor, Oliver Gray. Rhys would watch for another day and then make his move.
Oliver, why do you keep looking out that window?
Ivan Zharkov asked, looking up from the stove. He preferred to cook for himself when he was at the dacha. It reminded him of his humble beginnings. His children had missed the struggle of the early days, and that saddened him. While he had been forged through adversity, his children had grown up with the trappings of wealth, which bred a softness. All except Alexander, whose sickness had been his downfall. There's not even a fence out there, Pakhan.
That is because Siberia is our fence. Even the native people only infringe on the very edges, superstitious about the event that gave us this beautiful land.
Oliver had known about what the world termed the Tunguska event and had heard Zharkov tell of his connection to the area many times. The old man was fascinated with it.
The indigenous Evenks and Yakuts believe a deity sent a fireball as a warning. It was one they heeded. It destroyed 2,000 square kilometers, Oliver. Those that didn't initially believe were convinced afterward, when the sky glowed for days.
Did they ever figure out what it was? Asked Oliver, knowing there had been numerous theories and speculation over the years.
There was no crater. Some think it was a meteor that disintegrated before impact, the soft ground devouring its remains, absorbing its power. Others say it was an underground volcano. It may have been a comet, its ice becoming part of the land. I've even heard that it could have been a small black hole colliding with Earth. No one really knows. Over 110 years later, it remains the largest recorded impact event in recorded history, and nobody knows what it was. Regardless, we are in the epicenter of that event. Everything for 800 miles in every direction was destroyed except for right here. Those trees are all that are left, he said, gesturing out the large windows before him. Like the Genbaku Dome at the epicenter of the Hiroshima bomb the Americans dropped on Japan, those trees are all that remain. We too shall remain, Oliver. With the changing tides of geopolitics, the Bratva will remain.
I think you should still have additional security measures in place, Pakhan. If James Rhys comes, our guards won't stop him.
Oliver, how many times must we discuss this? Our source in the United States confirms that James Rhys is in Maryland. I have people watching the airports, train stations, shipyards, all ports of entry. Have his facial recognition data in their systems. He won't set foot inside Mother Russia without us knowing. He did take care of a rather nasty problem for me. Alexander is no longer a threat, planning to push the old lion out of the pride. My other children are enjoying their spoiled lives as the progenies of a Russian oligarch. There is nothing but tundra and wild animals in every direction.
James Rhys is not going to let me go, Pakhan. Oliver diverted his attention back out the windows that overlooked the helipad. Lights from the generators illuminated all sides of the compound. Beyond that was darkness. Stirring the borscht on the stovetop, Zharkov continued,
Do you know what would